increasingly they're seeing their country and their cities being destroyed. The infrastructure of the country is being destroyed. So when Israel attacks petrochemical installations, when it attacks gas fields that actually heat up Iranian homes, provide electricity, provide cooking oil, etc., Iranians are realizing that the war is on the country, not on them. And they are, as I said, they're high. This is a population that is very traumatized. 3.2 million Iranians have been displaced already by this war. Now, how the regime would behave towards them, I would say that it's likely to be incredibly intolerant of dissent. It's going to be repressive, there's not going to be an opening for the Iranian public after the war, and so I don't see a positive outcome here. I mean, the United States has all it's achieved, along with Israel, all they've achieved so far is actually to worsen the situation for the Iranian public, destroy their cities, the country's infrastructure, subject them to war, and transform the regime that they were already fighting against into a worse version of what had been there.
Listen, Nasser, before we go, we just have a minute. If you could say, how do you think this might end?
There's always a possibility that the Iranian regime will collapse, that there might be a tipping point that it will collapse, or that something very significant happens that it becomes willing to surrender or come to terms. But more likely is that this war could go on longer, and either the United States decides to escalate in a major way, which at some point mean boots on the ground, wars. You could start with assumptions that they would be short and you have an exit, but then they have their own rules. Or ultimately, President Trump will realize that this war is getting too costly and he cannot force his will on Iran. And there has to be a negotiated settlement to this war. And Iran already has outlined what it's expecting when that point comes, that it doesn't want a ceasefire. It wants a true end to the war between Iran and the United States, not only on this front, but also in Lebanon and in Yemen. And it wants the guarantees that war would not return. And it wants a significant change in Iran's economic situation, lifting of sanctions, perhaps some kind of compensation for the war. I mean, that's their asking initial demands. It suggests that they are quite confident that they could at least get some of that. And so at some point, President Trump may have to accept the fact that he started a war that is not going to give him what he expected. And he has to settle for an exit in order to be able to go back to the agenda that it had before. Otherwise, what we may actually really witness is that after close to two decades and three presidents saying that the United States does not want to get entangled in wars in the Middle East, we want to pivot to Asia, our priority is China, that we will end up doing exactly the opposite. Are we going to get ensnared in a long war in the Middle East? We're going to take our eyes off of everything else, and China will be in the end the winner of this American folly.
Ali Nasser, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Iranian-American professor of international affairs and Middle East studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, author of Iran's Grand Strategy, A Political History. His recent piece for the Financial Times, Iran is Playing a Long Game. Up next, as oil prices near $120 a barrel, we'll go to London to speak with Lala Khalili, author of Extractive Capitalism. Stay with us.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. In my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the form of shining valleys, where the pure air, rare. A newly opened, I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the work of fools. Upon the meek, the grace is showered. It's decreed the people rule. People have the power.
the Power by Patti Smith, performing at Democracy Now's 20th anniversary 10 years ago. On Monday, March 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating its 30th anniversary with Patti Smith and Michael Stipe and Angela Davis, Masab Abu-Toha, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and special guests, a surprise, so much more. You can watch our special live stream. For more information, go to democracynow.org. The event will take place at Riverside Church. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Global oil and natural gas prices are soaring after Israel bombed a massive natural gas reserve in Iran, the largest in the world. Iran retaliated by twice attacking the world's largest liquid natural gas production facility located in Qatar. Iran also attacked key energy infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. At one point today, the price of oil reached $118 a barrel, a 60% jump since the U.S. and Israel launched its war on Iran. In a post online, Trump threatened to blow up the entire South Pars gas field if Iran continues to target the Qatari facility. Trump also claimed the U.S., quote, knew nothing about the Israeli attack on the South Pars gas field. But the Wall Street Journal reports Trump approved the strike to pressure Iran to open up the critical Strait of Hormuz.
About 20% of the world's oil exports flows through the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump's asked other countries to send warships to help force open the strait, but many nations are rejecting the request. We're joined now by Lala Khalili, professor of Gulf Studies at University of Exeter and the author of several books, including her latest, Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy. She also wrote Sinews of War and Trade, Shipping and Capitalism in the Arabian Peninsula. Professor Khalili, thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by talking about the state of the Strait of Hormuz right now, its closure? President Trump, according to Reuters, perhaps sending in thousands of troops, what exactly this means, and the Israeli bombing of the South Pars gas field, the largest in the world. President Trump said in a rare rebuke, the U.S. didn't know. Most people are saying that is highly unlikely. That is probably untrue.
So Strait of Hormuz is one of the most important choke points for oil. A choke point being an area during which, if it's closed down, you end up getting a major disruption in the flow of global trade. So the Strait of Hormuz is one. Suez Canal is another one. The Panama Canal is another one. And there are a number of these different choke points all around the world. Now, what's specific about Hormuz and what's distinctive about it is that it is the choke point where the quantity of oil that goes through is higher than any other commodity that actually flows across the strait. As you just mentioned, about 30% of the global oil flows through that. And part of the reason for that is, of course, that the world's biggest oil producers, some of the biggest oil producers, are all sitting around the Persian / Arabian Gulf. So Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, Abu Dhabi, which all are huge producers of oil in the first place, and then natural gas in the case of Qatar and Iran in the second place. Now, what has been fascinating is that anybody who has one of these apps that you can put on your phone, like Maritime Traffic or Vessel Finder, you can actually take a look at the flow of traffic, the flow of vessel traffic, ship traffic, through these different seas in the world. And if you zoom in on the Strait of Hormuz, what you'll find is that instead of seeing actually a steady traffic of little, usually pink or green arrows going through, which indicate tankers, what you end up seeing are major clusters of ships that are bunched up very near ports where oil is produced and usually put on ships. What that indicates is that basically for a number of different reasons, and I'm going to go into that in a minute, the flow of ships, the flow of ship traffic has basically come to a halt. Now, the reasons behind this are multifold. Of course, there is number one, that Iran is attacking a number of the ships that are going through. And the way that it is attacking them is through the use of very cheap either drones or sea mines. And that means that it's basically almost impossible to deal with this particular threat, because the drones are produced so extensively in terms of number, and they're so inexpensive that they can basically be replenished even if they are destroyed. Also, being smaller, they're much harder to target, et cetera, et cetera. So there has been a number of drone attacks against ships carrying oil through the channel. And so, of course, that scares a lot of carriers, a lot of tankers. The second reason, which I actually think is perhaps even more significant, in part because it is actually not something that either the US or Iran can control, is that the moment something like this happens, the moment that there is a threat against ships, what you end up having is that insurance brokers, primarily situated in London, but there are, of course, some also in the US, China, and in Europe, but really the center for provision of maritime insurance is London at Lloyd's. And the ship brokers end up putting a specific war risk premium on ships. And that means that going from something like 1% of the cost of the hull, meaning the ship's body, or the cargo, meaning what it's carrying, goes to something like 5%, or it goes from a fraction of 1% to, say, 5%. And so that means that suddenly, instead of paying in the hundreds of thousands for insurance for a supertanker, what you're looking at is millions in insurance, which, of course, increases the cost of the oil that is traveling. So that's the second reason. The third reason is something that the Houthis noticed when they were blockading the Red Sea in support of the Palestinians when Israel was committing genocide against Palestinians. And that is that sometimes the threat alone suffices in getting the ships to stop going through, or indeed to make declarations that allows for them a degree of protection. So the Houthis, when they had blockaded the sea, had asked that any ships that claimed that they were not touching Israel, meaning they were not delivering to or picking up from Israel, could be allowed to go through the canal. And so it happened that this automatic identification system that a lot of ships, well, all ships carry, it's called the AIS system. And the AIS system indicates what ship is in the vicinity of the system, what it's carrying, and what flag it has, meaning which authorities it responds to. And so now what we're seeing is that apparently Iran has mentioned that any ship, for example, that is going to China will be let through, or any ship that is not coming from one of these allied states from the US to the US will be allowed through. Of course, there's a lot of variation in what kind of thing they have requested or what is being reported. So it's a lot harder to see what exactly the AIS systems are being on these ships. And as I said, we are mostly seeing them clustering and waiting in these locations. One of the main ones being the port of Fujairah, which is actually not in the Persian Gulf. It is in the Gulf of Oman. And oil from Abu Dhabi, which is on the Persian Gulf side, is shipped to Fujairah through a pipeline. So we're seeing a cluster of ships near Fujairah. Iran, of course, also attacked Fujairah port. And then we're seeing a cluster of ships near Ras Al Afan, which is the main gas production and gas lifting port in Qatar. And the third is, of course, around the oil fields of Saudi Arabia, a little bit further up the Persian Gulf. And so these clusters of ships are waiting there and hoping to be able to at some point pick up oil to be carried out. But we're not seeing much of that flow anywhere at all.
Professor Khalili, you mentioned that they are looking for the Iranians to see which vessels in the Strait of Hormuz, to what countries they're affiliated, looking at their flags. Chinese vessels have reportedly been permitted to pass through the strait. China imports about 40% of its oil from the Middle East and has been one of the largest buyers of Iranian oil. There are also reports that the Iranians are suggesting they'd consider allowing a small number of oil tankers to pass through the strait if the oil cargo is traded in Chinese yuan. rather than U.S. dollars. If you could comment on that.
This is really fascinating because, of course, we know that the fundamental basis of the U.S. imperial order since the end of the Second World War has been, on the one hand, petroleum, and on the other hand, the U.S. dollar. The globe's production and finance worlds are dependent on the petroleum that the U.S. has guaranteed the flow of since the end of the Second World War, and which, until the nationalization of oil in the 1970s and 80s, basically controlled something like 60% of the world's oil reserves. After nationalization, that percentage dropped dramatically. But the U.S. dollar continues to be, and the financial channels that the U.S. has crafted continue to be a very significant bolster for the empire. So the fact that Iran is actually looking for alternatives to the dollar in order to challenge the petrodollar regime, which is, as I said, one of the fundamentals of the U.S. empire, is a really interesting and quite clever indication of how the Iranians are hoping to influence the crafting of a world post this war, or a new world order post this war, where there is a multipolar financial system, where, for example, the dollar is no longer a single currency that rules the world, and the U.S. is the only channel that control, or the only power that controls financial channels. Because, of course, the U.S. has used this this inordinate power to strong arm various states, to institute sanctions, to make it difficult for its enemies, for example, to purchase oil, and of course it has used it to coerce a lot of countries, as we see, for example, in the case of Cuba or Iran, or indeed Russia, to do its bidding. So the fact that Iran is calling for petro-yuans to become an alternative to petrodollars is actually quite significant also in indicating that the Iranians are well aware of how extensively the U.S. has used its course of sanction capabilities through its control of the financial channels and through its mastery of the petrodollar, and are trying to erode that power.
And Professor Khalili, you know, the U.S. is now the world's largest oil producer. But because oil is a globally priced commodity, the price goes up in the U.S. if the world market price goes up. But
that's right.
How important do you think this might be in Trump's calculation? Because another consideration, another aspect of this, may be that as oil supplies diminish from the Middle East, the U.S. could benefit because it is the world's largest oil producer and the price of its oil will go up. And the demand for its oil.
Absolutely. What a fantastic question. Because, in fact, we have seen that when the Russian invasion of Ukraine began and the Nord Stream natural gas pipelines to Europe were sabotaged, there are now indications that this may have been done at the behest of the U.S. and its Ukrainian allies. But nevertheless, when that sabotage happened, it actually translated into massive gains for U.S. natural gas production. The thing is that there are a number of reasons why oil is not, why the U.S. cannot become the sole oil producer for the whole of the world. One is the question of proximity, for example. The second is the question of capacity that the U.S. has in order to actually replace, for example, the oil that is produced by Saudi Arabia or by Iran or indeed by Russia. But the third factor, and I think that this is the one that I think we should look out for, is that in the last 10 or 15 years, China has actually begun generating an alternative set of fuels, sustainable fuels, and developing technologies, particularly of electric and battery technologies, that will allow for example, solar or wind energy to displace fossil fuels. And the more that the price of oil goes up, which, of course, we have seen that happen, as you mentioned earlier, and in fact, this also translates into major windfalls for U.S. oil companies. This oil prices going up benefits Chevron. It benefits Exxon. It doesn't benefit the average U.S. citizen at the petrol stations, at the gas stations, but it does benefit the oil companies. So it definitely does, that does happen. But the higher the price of oil goes up, the relatively cheaper it becomes to actually have sustainable alternatives, which, of course, that means that it benefits China in a major way, since China is way ahead of the rest of the world in producing these technologies and in producing them cheaply. So the solar panels that are being produced in China are a fraction of the price of solar panels that were being produced something like 15 or 20 years ago. And I think this shift is actually is a major long-term concern for the oil companies. So in the short term, they're taking all the windfall that they can get. But this, again, is the kind of a post-war order that we will see will likely also have major implications for the kind of energy people are paying to use or people are willing to use, actually.
We just have 20 seconds, but the effect of the bombing of the Southpars facility, the largest gas facility in the world, what it means for Iran, what it means for the world, and President Trump denying the U.S. had anything to do with it, which most do not believe.
No, absolutely not. There is no way that Israel would have actually done this without coordination with the United States. And in fact, the channels that deny, for example, that the U.S. Coordinated or report Trump's denials are the channels that are often used to feed us the kinds of lies that the administration tells us. But what is quite significant about South Pars, and I know it's a very short time left, so I'm going to be very quick about it, is that the South Pars field is actually shared between Iran and Qatar. The North Dome, which is on the south part of the Persian Gulf, is Qatar's share of this major field. And Iran's bit is in the northern part of the Persian Gulf. And so the destruction of the infrastructure there will not only have an effect on Iranians' ability to produce electricity and fuel their various kinds of industries and or homes, but it will also have an effect on the infrastructure structures that are used by the Qataris and which the Iranians and Qataris have been using in an extraordinary degree of coordination since the fields have been utilized. So this actually also affects Qatar. The bombing itself also affects Qatar. And I don't think that this is a calculation that the rather know-nothing Trump administration has taken into account.
Lala Khalili, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Professor of Gulf Studies at University of Exeter, author of several books, including her latest, Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy. Thanks so much for being there. Up next, we go to Washington, D.C. to speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna about the War Powers Act and about the Epstein files. Why did Democrats walk out of a surprise closed-door hearing with AG Pam Bondi? Back in 15 seconds. Have the Power by Patti Smith, joined by Michael Stipe, performing in Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. On Monday, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary with Patti Smith, Michael Stipe, and so many others. Watch the live stream at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
We end today's show on Capitol Hill as the Pentagon is asking Congress for $200 billion for the war on Iran. We're joined by Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna of California. He and Republican Congressman Thomas Massie led the unsuccessful effort to pass a War Powers Act in an attempt to rein in President Trump's ability to wage the war against Iran.
Representative Ro Khanna, we thank you so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about, in the Senate again, a War Powers Act trying to rein in Trump being scuttled yesterday, and what you think can happen at this point.
The American people have already soured on the war. We've lost 13 American service members, and it's counting. The price of gas is up 27%. And now Donald Trump is saying that he's going to come to Congress to ask for $200 billion to fight in Iran, a total betrayal of his promise that he was going to focus on American needs. To put that in perspective, $200 billion would pay for free public college for every American kid. $10 a day child care. It would fully fund special needs education, and we'd have more money left over. So I do believe that Republicans now, some Republicans, are beginning to see that this is hurting the American economy, hurting American workers, and they may start to speak out against the war.
And Representative Khanna, the Wall Street Journal reported that an extraordinarily small group of people made the decision to go to war, including Vice President Vance, Secretary of State Rubio, Defense Secretary Hegseth, but a lot of leading U.S. diplomats and figures, officials working on the Middle East, were entirely excluded from these conversations and learned about the war through, like we did, through social media and the news. Your response to that?
Well, it's been totally irresponsibly planned. I mean, the reporting is that they did not anticipate that Iran would strike the Strait of Hormuz. They didn't anticipate that the price of oil would go up. They didn't anticipate the difficulty of actually getting regime changes. Killing Khamenei and having him replaced by his younger son did not topple the regime. They had no end game. They didn't even understand how they were going to get the quote-unquote enriched uranium, 400 kilograms of enriched uranium at 60%, that is buried under the nuclear facilities. So they had a split even in their administration, as we see with Joe Kent's resignation, as we see with Tulsi Gabbard saying she didn't look at the intelligence, she just let the president make the decisions, and they didn't consult any of the expertise.
I want to go from epic fury, what President Trump has called the war on Iran, to what some are describing, it should have been called Epstein fury, a distraction from what President Trump is very concerned about. On Wednesday, Democrats on the House Oversight Committee walked out of a closed-door briefing with Attorney General Pam Bondi and her deputy Todd Blanche less than an hour after Bondi repeatedly declined to say whether she would comply with a subpoena requiring her to appear for a sworn deposition on April 14th. You're a part of the House Oversight Committee, and you are the co-author of the Epstein Files Transparency Act. Can you tell us what happened late yesterday?
Well, I was there. Attorney General Pam Bondi and Deputy Attorney General started out by praising me and Thomas Massie for passing the bill. But then when we started asking basic questions like whether she was going to comply with the subpoena, she equivocated. When I asked her why they did not release the files of survivors naming names, they basically said, well, they were protecting survivors. That's not true. So we have insisted that she needs to come under oath on April 14th. James Comer has reiterated that, and I expect that will happen. She will have to answer for hours and hours questions about why there are still 3 million documents being hidden, why there was a cover-up of those files that implicated Donald Trump.
What was that hearing all about? A surprise to you, too, from the day before. You'd been calling for her to testify, and yet she wasn't even under oath. And if you can talk about Comer, the head of the House Oversight Committee, incredibly insulting Congressmember Summer Lee, telling her to stop bitching.
Well, it was a sexist slur against an African-American woman. It was totally uncalled for. He owes her an apology. He owes an explanation. I mean, that just harkens back to an ugly past period in American history. I believe she came there to try to earn some goodwill. She was, like I said, gracious initially about saying, actually, we needed the law. By the way, she herself acknowledged that it was more than Epstein and Maxwell, that there were many men who went to that island who were either implicated in horrendous behavior or who covered it up, and that this was not a hoax. But I think she really was trying to get out of her testimony in terms of the subpoena. It's not going to work. That's why House Democrats didn't ask long questions. We didn't want to give her an excuse not to show up at the deposition. She's going to show up. And
we're
that's
gonna
where
have
the
to leave
American
it there.
People
I thank
will
you
get
so
answers.
Much for being with us. Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna on the House Oversight Committee. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Hi there. This is Jan Arden. And if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the Internet at cjsf.ca.
Hi, I'm Chef Robert Rainford. Nearly one in three black children in Canada goes hungry while food gets thrown away. The Food Security Fund is changing that. Led by Support Black Charities, the plan is to build a better pathway from community gardens to nutritious meals through local food hubs. This isn't just charity. This is community infrastructure. Join us and build a better future for black families to have consistent, dignified access to good food. Join us at foodsecurityfund.ca. Contribute today. Thank you.